32, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Time to begin the tech nest. Almost 35 years. Night, there was a gathering of radio amateurs who are curious about radio and wireless equipment. Want to know a little bit more about how it works, how to make it work better. Gather here and share information with each other. Coming up. Not all the information you're going to get here is 100% accurate. Occasionally we make errors. But it's a kind of peer-reviewed material. In other words, people listening in will quite often correct the errors right on the spot. And even if not, everything that occurs on the TechNet becomes recorded. And you can play back those recordings by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. And there you'll find the website by Mike Perry, KC2NJI. For the last 10 or 11 years, he has recorded all of the TechNet. He chose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play them back. So, what errors are discovered?
This is Captain Perry.
Okay, David, just listening. One last call. Anyone else? check into the TechNet because you do have a question or comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now. T2RIW.
My transmitter working?
It is now, Joe. Go right ahead. I'm hearing you for the first time.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it?
Okay, are you checking in, Joe?
I tried to check in 8 times in a row.
We're all hearing you for the very first time. Okay, we got Joe. One last call. Anyone else to check in who has a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters right now. Okay, the mysterious person, KE2EJ, better known as Eric, got him on the list. Okay, let's start off with Andy first. N2HUH, go right ahead, Andy. And did you get a chance to go to the picnic today, the Limelight picnic at Bethpage State Park? You've got it, Andy.
Hello, Dick. If you were invited me personally, I would have went, even though I'm having a little medical issue today. But for you, I would have went. Nobody else, just you. I mean that sincerely. The question would be regarding, for now, RF final transistor devices, maybe even driver devices and HF radio. I'm being led to believe that possibly those devices can actually reduce in their output due to defect or abuse or whatever would cause that. I don't understand what would cause that, and I don't even know if it's possible that that device can actually operate at a reduced level. If you could maybe extrapolate on that and so that I can understand what would cause it and if it would actually happen.
Okay, Andy. Most modern day amateur 8 or 10 meter HF transceivers at the 100 watt level are quite rugged. Most of them have a built-in output network protection circuit which looks for reflected power. In other words, if you made the mistake of forgetting to connect the coax cable, where you've got a very high standing wave ratio antenna, something that will create a lot of reflected power, almost all of them will detect that reflected power and go into a self-protection function. They will either switch themselves into a standby mode or lower the amount of drive power, lower the power output of the final stage, so that they are controlling the amount of reflected power. Reflected power into the final stage could create overheating, could create voltage breakdown, could create damage to the final transistors. Nowadays, with modern day protection circuitry, that event is fairly rare. Yes, you could get secondary breakdown. If the total amount of reflected power was at a particular phase angle, the peak voltage that the final transistors would see could exceed the maximum voltage the transistors are supposed to see, or the maximum current they're supposed to tolerate. And some damage to the final transistors could take place, and that could lower their power output or decrease the power output to zero. Those are rare events nowadays. The two guys who are very familiar with that are Eric, KE2EJ, and Andy, WA2CDL. I'm going to pass it over to Eric, because I guarantee he's got some opinions on this. He has, on a number of occasions, replaced the final transistors in power amplifiers at repeaters and whatever because they were damaged.
Repeater, timeout.
So over to you, Eric, if you got some words on this one. KE2EJ, who has done some final transistor replacements on multiple occasions. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, if we're talking about handgear, most stuff actually has a little visual detector, and even the commercial stuff, there's probably two-way radios though. When it starts seeing 2-to-1 and higher, it starts to pull a drive back. Some of them actually lower the bias of the driver transistor and actually causes them to reduce its gain and pay for it with a little bit of clipping. But in my world, the new transmitters that I've been playing with, it's funny, these are kilowatt transistors, and you can short the bloody things out or leave them open, and they just don't really care. the structure of the transistor is a little bit different. As the newer transistors come out and hit the ham markets, we're going to start to see some of that stuff. But you still want to protect it. Because you want to protect the power supply, you don't want to draw all that current, you don't want to generate all that heat. But, HF radios, same way. We will visualize detection as some particular point starts to fold back to drive to the amplifier, and the amplifier doesn't hit with too much voltage, too much current. And one of the things about transistors that we use, there are actually multiple transistors in one package, and that's how they're able to generate the power and dissipate the heat. DRIWK 2J. In the early days, I think they used to call that the overlay design, where there were a whole bunch of transistors in parallel. And where damage occurred, some of those parallel transistors got blown open, blown shorted, or whatever, but those are rare events. The really modern transistors that Eric was telling us about are being made almost idiot-proof. They can tolerate dead short circuits and open circuits and just keep right on cranking. But almost all of our amateur transmitters, for at least 10 years that I know of, probably longer, have a built-in protection circuit. So damage to the final transistor because of pilot error in the shack, fairly rare. And if you've got a bird wattmeter, it's fairly easy to find out exactly what power output your transmitter is producing and how much reflective power you're getting from the antenna. And if the forward power is supposed to be 100 watts and it's only 50, but the reflective power is showing 25, meaning you've got a very high standing wave ratio, then you know why the power output is low. That's the effect of the protection circuit. Yeah. 50 watts going forward and 0 watts coming back on your bird wattmeter, then yes, if the drive is set at full level, it would indicate a possible error to the final stage. But that's relatively rare. So you probably don't have to lose a lot of sleep over that one, Andy.
I got a comment, Dick.
Go right ahead, Eric. Wait for the beep.
Most guys who operate HF with a antenna tuner, if you look carefully at your meters, as you go and peak, when you go to peak and make that match, you'll see that you've got your maximum power output where the antenna tuner makes the whole chain resonant. And as you're tuning it, if you watch the collector current in the radio, you'll see the collector current go up and down according to how the tuning is. At peak, you'll find the maximum collector current, and as you detour it, you'll see the collector current actually drop. That's the protection circuit kicking in.
Yeah, if you do have an external antenna tuner, even if the antenna system itself has a fairly high standing wave ratio, as long as your antenna tuner has not run out of range and can arrive at a good tuning procedure, it forces the input impedance to the antenna tuner that's presented to your transceiver to be a pure 50 ohm resistive load, 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, in which case your transmitter should be able to produce full power output. So a bird wattmeter put between the transmitter and the antenna tuner will show maximum forward power, zero reverse power, when the antenna tuner is properly tuned. Bird wattmeter put after the antenna tuner might very well show 150 watts forward and 50 watts coming back. And those are realistic numbers that could really occur because of reflected power from the antenna hitting the output stage of the antenna tuner. And when it's properly tuned, all of that power gets re-reflected forward and adds to the power coming out of the transmitter at this time. So that an antenna with a fairly high standing wave ratio, as long as the feed line is fairly low in loss, essentially all that power gets radiated anyhow. You say those exact words on 20 meters, you'd be amazed how many people will disagree with you.
I got another comment.
Okay, and Eric, there's a whole bunch of people out there who believe that all the reflected power from an antenna that's less than ideal in its impedance, all that reflected power come back to the antenna tuner, that the antenna tuner just simply throws that power away. Absolutely not. My conservation of energy can't do that. It's well shielded, so it's not radiated, that power. A 1-to-1 standing wave ratio at the input end of the antenna tuner shows that none of it's going back to the transmitter. And so, if it's made out of high-quality components, it runs ice cold, it's not turning the power into heat, it's not radiating it, and it's not passing it through back to the transmitter. By conservation of energy, the laws of physics, there's nothing left but to re-reflect that power.
the comments about antenna tuners, probably. K2RIW, good, Eric.
GCS.
Eric,
I was just talking about this, Ryan. It reminds me of the old days. You go back 30 years or a little more, you happen to have a 6146 or some type of tube like that, and if you mistuned it, because they didn't have the VSWR protection circuits in there, you would watch the plate of your tube. You knew if it was glowing red, you really were not resonant.
Yeah, the extra current and voltage and mismatched power could make the final stage of run red hot. But the good thing about tubes is they can tolerate an awful lot of abuse, within reason, for a short period of time. There was another person with a very garbled voice who tried to sign in, who had a further comment. Take your time, sir. Give us your full call, those, your name, and then your comment. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
I just switched over to the East End. WBGCSE. I was going to comment that along with the high reflected power also comes a change in angle of radiation in the antenna.
WB2CSE. Okay, tell us what you're saying. Are you telling the angle of radiation from the antenna is affected by the tuning of the antenna tuner? Is that what you're suggesting? Over to you.
So when the antenna is not resonant where you are, the angle of radiation will change, which is what you see after the antenna tuner. Since you can see the forward reflected power there. It may not be radiating in the desired direction, the additional power, but it's radiating somewhere.
Okay, run that by again. Whenever there is a mismatch of the antenna, it's got high standing wave ratio, a certain amount of power coming down the transmission line doesn't immediately get radiated. A certain percentage of it gets reflected back. But by changing the impedance on the input end of an antenna, that's what your antenna tuner is doing, are you about to tell me that changes the antenna pattern of the antenna? I'm saying the pattern of an antenna is fixed by the real estate, the physics. Your antenna is, if it's a wire antenna, for instance, it has a particular layout.
It works with collinear.
Okay, even with a collinear antenna. If you're not changing the impedance match within the original elements, individual elements of the collinear, I mean, if whatever power gets radiated goes up and down because you do or don't create a better match with the antenna tuner, changing the power to an antenna does not change the antenna pattern. So what are you saying here? WB2CSE. I think it's WB2CSE. Please tell us your name. K2RIW.
Hi, Dick. It's Steve, and it's a Zulu Sugar Echo. No, I'm just saying in general, when you're not resonant with the antenna, whether you're using an antenna tuner or not, your angle of radiation is going to change. The only thing the antenna tuner is going to do, as you point out, is the additional power is going to get radiated out instead of thrown away, but it may not be in its desired direction. Or it may actually improve things, depending on whether you're higher or lower in frequency than the antenna's resonance, and by how much.
Okay, now let me back up and hear this again, Steve. What about the tuning of the antenna by way of an antenna tuner capable of changing the pattern of the antenna? Well, let me reverse that. Tell me what I can do to an antenna to change its radiation pattern. W2 Zebra, Sierra Echo, K2IW. Go ahead, Steve.
The frequency that you're transmitting into it. In other words, if your antenna is resonant on, say, 146.85, and you have a higher, say, a 2 to 1 SWR on 147.5, your angle of radiation will change slightly, and as you go further out of resonance, it will change. Now, the addition of the extra power that you're transferring to the antenna because it's a tuner can actually help in some circumstances and hinder in others.
Okay, our antennas are set a certain number of wavelengths above the ground. If I change the frequency that I'm transmitting, I'm changing the number of wavelengths, and yes, that will change the antenna pattern slightly. However, let me assume now that I've got a Yagi antenna aimed at the horizon, and it's a 2-meter Yagi, and it has a certain antenna pattern at 146.85. And now, I disturb the driven element of that Yagi. It had a 1-to-1 standing wave shear. I do something to the driven element.
UPS.
UPS recognized. I do something to the driven element of that Yagi, like put a clip lead on the end of the driven element of the Yagi, changing the standing wave ratio of the driven element of that Yagi. I say that that is going to change the amount of power I radiate, but that's not going to change the pattern. The pattern is set up by the focusing action of that director string and the reflector, and the driven element just feeds that whole network. So changing the standing wave ratio of that Yagi by disturbing the driven element, I say, will not change the pattern of that Yagi. Steve, are you saying something different? WB2ZSE, KQRIW.
As I recall, and as Eric pointed out, I deal with mostly collinear antennas on VHF and UHF. It's changed that would be the vertical angle of radiation from that antenna. And I'm going to be home soon, so I don't want to hold this thing up. And I understand Richie just signed it. So let me toss it back to you and let you go around to him. He may have a comment on this.
Okay, Rich, K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, probably mobile.
I'll take it after it.
And maybe, Eric, after that. Rich, where are you located with your mobile? And please give us your information. K2 UPS, mobile, most likely. K2 RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Dick, and after the net, K2 UPS, mobile. I'm in Ohio right now, just a little bit east of Zanesville, heading back to New York. And I think I understand what Steve is trying to say, and maybe if I do, and I give you a slightly different scenario, it might make sense. Instead of taking, say, a 2-meter beam that was cut for 144, and now you want to operate at 146 to 147, where there's a higher SWR, think of, say, a 10-meter quarter-wave ground-mounted vertical, and that is resonant on 10 meters, and that's going to have a certain takeoff angle, the DX, when it's resonant without using a tuner. If you have a big enough tuner and you tune that thing on to say 15 or 20 meters, you're changing that antenna is no longer a quarter wave at the frequency that you want, and the antenna pattern on the takeoff angle is now different. I think that's what Steve was trying to get across.
I accept that. I accept that, Rich. A 10-meter ground plane antenna set on 15 or 20 meters will have a different pattern. But that different pattern happens to be happening simultaneously with, it's not tuned there and it's got a different amount of VSWR. But the VSWR itself did not change the pattern, is what I'm saying. If I did something, if I changed the network I had at the base of that 10-meter ground plane antenna, so that now it presented a good impedance at 15 or 20 meters, that in itself would not change the pattern at 15 or 20 meters, is what I'm saying. I wonder if you agree with that, Rich. KTUPS, mobile, K2RIW.
Excuse me, I have to leave. WB2ZSE.
K2UPS, for any further comment on that? Over to you, Rich.
Okay, I don't think Steve is saying either that the SWR itself is changing antenna pattern. He just said if the SWR is going up because you are moving away from the resonant frequency of that antenna, even if it's a three-element beam or whatever, the tuner is going to make the radio happy, but it's just the further you get from where that antenna is resonant, and if it's a very, very narrow banded antenna, the SWR rush pretty quickly as you move away from it. Even in a beam, I still believe, I think it does, that will affect the pattern to some extent. You have to retune antenna or redo it to make it resonant now at the new point to get the same pattern that you had at the other frequency when it was resonant. Or maybe I'm not getting what you guys are trying to get, but that's what I think it was being said.
I give you my 2 cents.
Eric recognized, I'm going to give it to him next. I want to divide and conquer here, and not mix the two things together. Every antenna, if you change the frequency you're feeding the antenna, in general, you're going to change its pattern. The pattern is a function of frequency. Step number one. Depending on where the antenna is tuned, as you change frequency, you may develop some standing wave ratio. Step number two. But standing wave ratio itself does not change the pattern. You've changed the pattern because you fed a new frequency to that antenna, and now that antenna has a different number of wavelengths above the ground, and the elements within the antenna have different ways that they behave at that new frequency. And so I could put a remote tuning network at the base of the antenna so that with the proper operation of the remote tuning network, no matter what frequency I feed into the antenna, I always get a one-to-one standing wave ratio. That's not going to change the fact that at each individual frequency, the antenna has a particular pattern. So I want to separate the two functions. Antenna pattern as a function of frequency, that's a given. A pattern, antenna VISWA as a function of frequency, that's a given. But the VISWA itself did not change the pattern in general. So the fact that you got reflective pattern, power, doesn't change the pattern of the antenna's radiation, whatever percentage gets radiated. That's what I'm saying. KE2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
KRW, KE2EJ. Well, let me clarify something. I understand what Steve is saying. Works in the commercial world. Most of his work is vertical, okay? And typically it's a collinear, station master. And as you know, you can change the pattern of his station master by various different methods of mounting and putting stuff around the antenna to do stuff. But in Steve's world, the Q of the antenna is relatively high and the bandwidth is relatively small. So, he's not using, say, a beam, okay? We're generating gain by the segments of coax that's inside the antenna that's cut to a very specific frequency. And his world, they don't use an antenna tuner. So, when he tries to feed a different frequency in there, he's going to wind up with VISWA because the antenna is not resonant at that frequency. And as you change the frequency itself, that's going to change the pattern. The fact that he sees a different VISWA, he's associating the VISWA with the pattern because the antenna is designed to be at a very specific or a very narrow range of frequencies. You can't help but the pattern changes. And that's why you've got the response from him in that way. But it's not the VISWA that's causing the problem. It's the fact that you're trying to make the antenna resonate where it won't. K2RW, K2J.
Now you're saying it's a function of the antenna, you're trying to make it resonate where it won't. I say you're feeding it a frequency which it was not designed for. If I take that collinear, carefully tuned to 144 megacycles, and I feed it at 148, and I might, in that station master at 148, get a huge standing wave ratio, and I'm going to get a very different antenna pattern. However, even if I put a perfect antenna tuner at the base of that station master, and I make a perfect match, apparent match, at 148, I'm still going to get that same yucky antenna pattern at 148. The VISWA gives you a clue that you're doing something wrong. The VISWA itself did not change the antenna pattern, is what I'm saying.
And the point of the matter is that they don't work with antenna tuners, so they have an antenna that tunes a specific frequency, and as you go away from it, you can't help for the pattern to change. And as a result, you start to see VISWA.
Okay, so when he sees VISWA on his commercial antennas, it tells him there's something wrong. Is he feeding it at the wrong frequency compared to where it's designed, or some kind of a failure has occurred?
Yeah, feeding it the wrong frequency, but we'll agree.
So, the presence of VISWA on his commercial antenna tells him something needs correction. I accept that. And because it needs correction, quite possibly a secondary effect of the wrong frequency is changing the pattern. The pancake pattern of the collinear is no longer on the horizon, we'll say. It's now above or below the horizon when you're high or low in frequency. So, but the two separate effects, there's a huge number of people out there who think that if you do something to change the standing wave ratio of an antenna on a fixed frequency, that you're changing the antenna pattern. There's a huge number of people out there who believe that. I'm saying that that's a false belief that has been propagated by a whole lot of people, because some amateurs hear it so often, they've come to believe it. And so I'm saying divide and conquer here. Separate phenomena. Visual versus frequency, phenomenon number one. Pattern versus frequency, phenomenon number two. But Visual did not change the pattern directly. It's an indirect phenomenon. I know we're off the center frequency, of which you originally asked Andy. I'm going to pass it back to you, Andy, if you want to be filled on what you just heard. And to H-U-H, the guy who asked the original question, and we went very far left of center, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
All right, yo. Very good. Please make sure. I don't know. Anyway, the pretty much answered the question, and I'll take the extra. I'll take the extra information and run with that too. So the bottom line is, yes, my PA devices or my driver device can get damaged, and it may not perform to spec anymore. And very good. I'll keep my eyes out for that. I may have a situation like that. I've seen open and closed PA devices in the past, but never one that is actually not performing up to spec because of some type of damage. Very good. And thank you much. Take it light. That's 73 from Andy. N2H2H. Nice to have. Useful AMs. Otherwise known as Handy Andy. Ciao for now.
Andy, was this in relation to that amplifier that you blew up the alpha transistor?
You have me confused with another customer, Eric. I don't have any. I never blew up an amplifier, but I did actually get into that discussion also. So no, this is having to do with a HF transceiver that is only putting out about outputting about 40 watts instead of 100, and want to know if devices can actually get damaged so that they don't put out full output anymore. On you know, that sort of situation. Thanks, Eric.
Andy, you're getting 40 watts out of a rig. What do you know about the past history? If it used to put out 100, buy it used in as-is condition? Give us a few words on that. Back to you, Andy.
Yes, it always put out at least 100 watts, and a week later it's only putting out 40 watts on all bands, dummy load, all antennas. Yes, I changed cables, use the same cable on a different radio. Radio works fine. I looked at the, I tested the devices all checked out with an ohmmeter, didn't go any further, so I'm just wondering if there's a possibility of, you know, anything from a bad solder connection somewhere, a resistor somewhere, a capacitor, or possibly a device is just not performing to spec anymore. And a simple ohmmeter check is not going to, it's not an open or a closed bad device. It's a inferior device, possibly.
Andy, what are you using to sense what you believe is 40 watts? How are you sensing 40 watts into what I think you said is a dummy load? Go ahead.
Radio's internal meter, external meter, and antenna tuner meter, antenna matchup meter. I look at them as a matcher. So three different meters are all basically indicating the same output. FM, sideband, W.
One of those meters sensing the power output, is that something of high quality, like a Bird Model 43 watt meter? Over to you, Andy.
One is a military URM, the other is a Motorola. And on those meters, do read 100 watt output on other radios and previously on this same radio.
And when you operate the drive control and the tuning controls, if there was any, on that transmitter, maybe it's a no-tune type transmitter, when you operate the drive control, and as you advance the drive control, do you see it come up to 40 watts, and then you continue to turn the drive control, it sort of flat tops, nothing further happens? Is that what you're seeing happen, Andy? Go ahead.
Affirmative, QSL.
Okay. That's not a showstopper, but that is troublesome, and that does sound like something you want to do some further checking on. So, Andy Demetri-CDL could probably look at that for you and make a pronouncement as to whether or not a final stage has, by some mysterious effect, gotten damaged, and could bring that up to 100 watts for you if you like. So, I guess you'd have to consider that. Over to you, okay, good luck with that, and let us know what you do in the future on that one, Andy. Bob was next. WB2JOB. Go right ahead, Bob. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm a newbie,
$59, $50, whatever he paid for it, and they told him to keep the radio, don't even send it back. So in essence, he's got a free radio out of it. And I told him, I said, you know, you really don't hear that clicking unless you're really on top of the radio. In fact, he could turn it facing down on the cushion, and you can't hear the clicking. So I said, look, you got a free radio out of it. It works perfectly other than that. The transmitting fine. His audio is great. It's only when the radio is shut off that he hears that clicking. And by the way, it's every 2 seconds. I timed that also. So I said, look, live with it until you get yourself another radio. It's working other than that. If it really bothers you, take the battery out of the radio when you put it down. So that's the story on that. So back to you, Dick.
In the process of you putting in various amounts of voltage on that one, Bob, did you come to the conclusion as to where the clicking sound is coming out of? And maybe not. Go to V2JOB, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, it's definitely coming out of the speaker because I have an Icon speaker mic, a real one bought from an Icon distributor, which I plugged into his radio, and it does come out of the speaker that's in the radio itself. So it's coming directly out of the speaker itself. And I don't know, it might have been bad sort of connection, it could have been dropped. I don't know what happened to it between China and here. But like I told him, I said, for what you paid for it, just chalk it up to experience. Don't buy from the Chinese manufacturers. Try to get it from a reputable dealer. So he's going to live with it because he doesn't want me to open it up. I don't want to open up somebody else's radio unless they ask me to. So I'd rather not. I have no schematics on that. Even if it was original Icom, you know, I'd send it back. I wouldn't have a schematic on that either. But it is definitely coming from the speaker, though, Dick.
That'd be fun to pick. Yeah, your best guess is that there is something funny going on with the microprocessor. Is that true, Eric?
How could we want a few things? Generally, those radios have a transistor and a couple diodes and a cap that sits across the power line that goes to the power switch. When the power switch is activated, it then turns the main power on to the radio. So it sounds like it's got a little relaxation oscillator going in that circuit, whereas that maybe its capacitor is not connected to the right point, or they have the wrong value in there, or it could even be the gain of that transistor is a little bit wrong. So that ticking that he hears is power being applied to the circuit to the radio for, you know, a fraction of a moment, and then it goes back off. So the other thing is there's usually a watchdog timer, but that usually gets turned on by whatever that switching circuit is that starts the radio up. And I've seen in some of the single chip radios that actually is active all the time. And, you know, it draws microamps, but it'd be enough to kick the processor to think that, oh, I'm starting, and then all of a sudden there's no voltage there. So it'd be something in that part of the radio that's probably creating the issue.
Yeah, when it comes to funny clicking noises out of Baofeng, Luxong, my Baofeng handy talky, one of them gives me a continuous clicking function, which I'm pretty sure is due to the dual watch function with monitoring two frequencies. And once every second or so, you hear it click over to the other frequency, which I think is function number 7, which I haven't gotten around to turning off yet. Another one of my Baofengs, when you shake it, you hear a clicking sound. And ordinarily, you know, something mechanically moving, you say, hey, my shaking is doing it. And depending on how you shake it, you say, hey, the shaking and the clicking does not correlate. I can just move the radio vertically, very slowly, and I hear clicking. And I'm not doing any shaking at all. What I finally figured out what's happening on one of my Waxongs, Baofengs, is that the signal strength indicator, as it flips between 10%, 30%, 50% of deflection, makes a click during the change. When I move the radio, the amount of signal strength it sees changes, and therefore you hear a click. I can have the radio sitting absolutely steady, wrap my hand around the antenna, which is changing signal strength, and I'll hear a click. So in other words, there's some kind of a feedback between the signal strength function and the audio output on one of my Baofengs. Ain't that a strange one, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RW, K2JL. It's probably a bypass capacitor that's missing or... No, they flow sorted. Those things aren't flow sorted. They're put in an oven. Sometimes when they put the... after they put the solder mask down, they sweep the solder over the pads before the parts are placed and goes into the oven sometimes. You know, you're missing a little solder there, and the bypass capacitor, you know, the little complex circuit that drives the LCD might be causing a little bit of RF interference.
Contestant Hamed, WB2JOB.
Okay, Mr. JOB, go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, in regards to the Vulcans, I actually, out of curiosity, took a UV-5 apart just to see what was the condition of the workmanship. I was kind of impressed. I took the whole thing apart, looked at all the solder joints with a 6X group, and it did a halfway, at least from the one that I took apart, did a halfway decent job on it. You got to be very careful, though, with the wires on the side with the PP switches. If you're not careful, you pop them on if you don't know where they go. So it happens to be I have a schematic on the Vulcan on the UV-5. In fact, I have one on the UV-82 up online. But I was impressed with the workmanship. It wasn't bad considering for a $29 radio. I thought it was well worth it. Just my comment, Dick. Thank you.
Just like you, Bob, I've taken apart a couple of them, and I was amazed at the small number of dollars we're paying and the amount of quality we're getting. What you see inside looks awful good. And you got to be careful about how you take it apart and how you put it back together. It's a very tight fit of that kind of circuit board, so to speak, in there with getting the wiring dressed just right so you're not pinching it and so on. And get everything to go back together correctly with the push buttons working on the outside just right. But we're definitely getting our money's worth.
Well, it's weird how there's so little stuff in it.
Yeah, almost everything is inside of that microprocessor. It's almost a complete radio inside the microprocessor. Over to you, Eric.
Actually, two chips. One is a control chip, and the other one is the RF chip.
But it's not at such a cheap price. If every eighth radio we buy happens to be a defective one, we're still getting our money's worth from my point of view. I mean, a handy talkie. In the early days, we used to pay you a good fraction of $1,000 for these things. It's out to pay you $30 for them. It's what? 33 times cheaper. You can't complain. Satisfied. It reminds me of the guys who found out that I was getting CATV hardline cable from my particular warehouse locally free of charge. And some guy went to his local warehouse of a cable company, and they were going to charge him a nuisance fee of $15 for a roll of 200 feet of it. He's getting $1,000 worth of cable. He's being charged $15. He found out I had got it for free. Therefore, he felt cheated, and he turned down the deal. Craziness. He's getting $1,000 worth of high-quality cable, and he's being charged $15. I told him to go back to that guy, apologize, hand him $15, give the guy another $5 tip, and then take away the $1,000 worth of cable that we're offering to you. So we sometimes really misunderstand the true value in dollars versus what we're getting. Anyway, any further comments? K2IW, the TechNet?
Yeah, WB2JOB.
Go ahead, Bob. Wait for the beep.
You were talking about price. I think I paid under $300 for my first IC2AT and my IC3AT, and the IC2AT, in fact, didn't even have a PO in it. I had to go to communication specialist when we finally put a PO on our repeater, and that was a dip switch, you know, except one repeater, you know, that was it. The other way, you had to open it up. So when you consider what you're getting today for $29 and what we paid almost $300 for back in the old days, it's certainly marvelous how they can do that for that kind of money. Of course, it's cheap labor, but still, the cases are nicely made. They're really solidly made. I've dropped mine a number of times, and no damage to it whatsoever. It doesn't even get dented. So I'm impressed with it. In any case, thanks a lot for all the information, Dick. I appreciate everybody getting back to me, and my friend's just going to have to live with it. Listen, you got a free radio, so it trips every 2 seconds when it's in your position. What the heck? For a free one, what can you expect? So K2RAW and the group WB2JOB. Thanks a lot.
Did you have it open at Motorola HT220?
No, it was an ICOM, IC2AT. IC3AT was an ICOM.
Yeah, I really like the IC2AT, and I still use one of those today, because it's so easy to program to a new frequency just by flipping those dials up top, whereas the Balfongs give you a lot of radio for the money, but programming them is a bit of a dog from the front panel. So, pays your money, takes your choice. Okay, Bob number two, Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor Bravo. We should be able to hear you this time, Bob. Over to you, Bob number two, K2RIW. Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor Bravo. One more call. Over to you, Bob. It's your turn now, K2RIW. Guys, stop keying up. You'll hear him. He's not echoing. You need the 5 seconds before you can pick it up.
Okay, this is Bob. I'm sorry for the delay. I'm on Echo Link, and I'm a newbie, and I'm a newbie to Echo Link. I didn't do it properly. It wasn't coming through. Anyway, sorry again about stepping on that previous broadcast. Confusion there. My question is probably a newbie question. I have also a Balfang type radio. It's the UV5X3. It's a tri-band, or else it gets 220. And my question is, I'm going to northern Minnesota in about a couple weeks. We're going to be on an island up on Rainy Lake, if anyone knows where that is. It's 13 miles from International Falls, Minnesota. This is on the border of Canada. And it's about, yeah, it's like 13 miles from there, and I'm just wondering about any suggestions about a kind of portable antenna that I can hook to this radio to maximize my chances of being able to reach that repeater. It's a VHF repeater. I think it's like a 140. I can look up the exact frequency if it's necessary. Anyway, I guess that's it for now. I'll post the question over to you. That's KD2NDB.
Okay. I think your question is that what should you use for a external antenna with high performance on this tri-band radio? By the way, the Balfang UV5R series of radios, they come with a very nice rubber duck antenna that works across all of those frequencies on 450 and 2 meters very nicely. But be careful that you do not bend that rubber duck antenna. It can only tolerate a very small number of bends before it develops an internal open circuit that's quite difficult to fix. So do not bend, and don't put that radio in your pocket.
Under the brakes, that's right.
Yeah, there's a 3 picofarad capacitor that becomes disconnected. So make sure you do not bend the rubber duck antenna. There are replacement antennas you can buy for that radio, which do not perform as well as the one that it shipped with. So try to keep the one that it shipped with in good working order by do not bend it. Do not drop it. Don't do anything to bend that rubber duck antenna, and you'll get some very nice service for a long period of time. I've repaired that rubber duck antenna on multiple occasions because I did bend it, and it's a fairly difficult procedure, I'll warn you. So what Bob number two is looking for now is a suggestion for, I guess, using an external antenna, not the one that it's supplied with, that'll work on the three bands. Do I have you correctly on that question, Bob? Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor, Bravo. Ready, Phil, K2RIW.
Yes, that's basically my question. It doesn't, even if it all worked on the two bands and skipped the 220, it doesn't seem like you get much on 220, so I don't know about up there. Anyway, I've gotten a few things. So even when it worked on two bands would be good. I can always bounce back and forth. I did hear your show last week, so I remember your detailed talk about the antenna and bending, and I said to myself, okay, I'm always going to take it off when I, transport it. I'll unscrew the antenna and package separately. So, yes, I am looking for suggestions for, if there there's anything better, even a bigger thing I'd have to hold, or even like a car top magnet antenna, because we're going to have a house though. Of course, I don't know if the roof's going to be made of metal or fiberglass, but I could probably stick that somewhere, and that would probably improve things. Over to you.
K2UPS with a comment.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Dick and Bob. I might suggest the Elk. I think it's an antenna made by Elk Manufacturing or Elk Mountain. It's a 440 beam, meant to be handheld, I believe, or it can be handheld, but you can probably also very easily rig it and attach to like a painter's pole or a short piece of PVC pipe if you're in a houseboat, and just use the Armstrong method to rotate it in different directions. That'll give you a little bit of gain in one direction, better than any other omnidirectional might work. Plus, the antenna breaks down easily for portability. I believe it's made by Elk Mountain.
Thank you, Rich. That's a nice suggestion. When it comes to running a handy talkie from inside of an automobile, the automobile is partially shielding any kind of an antenna mag mount on the roof of the car. It's going to make a 5 or 10 dB improvement. Mail order house that sells you these modern day handy talkies, quite a few of them will sell you a very inexpensive mag mount antenna. So assuming the mag mount antenna is working correctly, mounting it on the roof of the car while you're mobile is going to give you a lot of performance. Now, there's an amazing number of people who think that an omnidirectional antenna, external, is going to give you a hell of a lot more gain. The answer is almost no. There are three things to make a VHF antenna work well. Altitude. The rubber duck antenna that's on the handy talkie. You can put yourself and that handy talkie at a high enough location, you're going to get a hell of a lot more performance. Just having an external antenna that's omnidirectional, that's 5 feet away from you, connected with a wire to the handy-talkie, that's not going to make a hell of a lot of improvement. The rubber duck that's on the handy-talkie, everybody thinks they've got a low performance efficiency. Not true. With rare exception, they're giving you 90% efficiency, if you know what I mean. So the location of the antenna is the main thing that gives you performance. Let me drop this. Now, that external antenna, now a cable going to a mag mount on top of the car, outside of the car, you're going to get a lot more performance. If it's 30 feet of cable that goes to the second floor of your house, getting a lot more altitude of the antenna, that's going to give you a lot more performance. But just going to an external antenna from the handy talkie, which is also omnidirectional, you think you're going to get a lot more performance out of it? Absolutely not. It'll be the same as the rubber duck. So, unless you go to something like what Rich is now talking about, a Yagi-like structure. So mag mount first if you want to operate mobile, and then when it comes to an external antenna, if it's not something that's got gain to it, which you have to aim it in the right direction, until you're able to add extra altitude, you're not going to get a hell of a lot more performance, in my opinion. There are people who think that, this external antenna is rated for 3 dB of gain, and my rubber duck is only rated for 1 dB of gain. I'm going to get 3 times more efficiency out of the external antenna. Don't you believe it. 3 dB versus 1 dB, you'd never see the difference on FM performance, if you know what I mean. Wonder if that makes a little bit of sense about K2 November, Victor, Bravo, K2LIW.
WB2JOB, comment.
JOB, stand by. Bob first, go ahead.
Yes, I hear you, Dick. I'm just learning all this stuff, so I'm thinking the terrain might be on a lake, and it's pretty flat up there, except for, of course, there are trees, and so I guess maybe if I just get on, like, a higher point of this island I'm going to be on, like a point, of course, short of, I don't think I'm going to be climbing trees, but other than that, you think my odds are to get to this 13 miles away repeater? I mean, I can hear it probably, but will I be able to, do you think there's a good chance I'll be able to broadcast to it and it'll pick me up at 5 watts? It's KD2NDP, over to you, or anybody.
Yeah, with rare exception, if you can hear a repeater fairly well where you're standing, even though you're only running 5 watts from a handy talkie, 90% of the time that repeater is going to hear you. one other thing to be a little bit concerned with, and that is every repeater has an offset frequency between transmit and receive. 600 KC offset on 2 meters, 5 megacycles offset on 450. Because you're transmitting on a slightly different